To the witching hour, somewhere between abnormal and paranormal. Enter at your own risk into the paranormal.
Of Oregon. We did 3 hours last night, and we've got two more hours tonight as we kind of just let go, let everything go, and sit back and maybe put the covers high above our shoulders and tuck them in real tight. And we've got one more of those kind of spooky, scary, skin-crawling shows for you, kind of basically like last night, all over again. And my first guest tonight, as we do the virtual Oregon Ghost Conference here on the radio this weekend, since of course we couldn't be gathered together in person, Sharon Sananda has been helping people since 2002 as a spiritual counselor, psychic medium, a channel, a hypnotherapist, specializing in past life therapy, paranormal investigation, and she's a photographer as well, along with a metaphysical teacher. She's the founder of Light Journeys Metaphysical Fair and the Camaro Academy of Transformation. Tracy Gorman joining us as well. She's been deliberately taking orb photos since mid-2017. She's an open-minded skeptic when it comes to the paranormal and started getting unusual energies and orbs in her photos. She has done extensive research on the subject and started taking photos in her yard at night. Well, here we are 8 cameras later, and she now has a collection of hundreds of thousands of orb energy and plasma photos. Sharon, Tracy, welcome into the paranormal. So good to have both of you here.
Thank you, Jeremy. It's great to be here.
Thank you, Jeremy.
So let's start with you, Sharon. Tell us about how you got involved in this line of work.
In this line of work? Well, I would say about 20 years ago or so, we lost some family members, and then I had what's called a near-death experience it was in 2001, and things just started happening for me where I started opening up in a really intensive way. And I never since then, I haven't I haven't gone back to, you know, the, I guess you could say, normal life. And anything that's woo-woo, anything that's metaphysical or paranormal, I guess you could say, is pretty much my life. I'm immersed in it, and it's my life, and I love helping people as well. I just started during my, what I call a quickening or awakening, whatever you want to call it. I started becoming aware of my abilities and my gifts, and we all have them. You know, we just have our niches, and was able to help people with remembering. My goal is to help people remember their true self and live a life that we're all meant to live.
Do you think that near-death experience was key in starting you on this journey?
I think that it was, probably. I mean, it had started before then. I think the catalyst for me was losing our parents, and that's about what did it for me. That started the journey, and then the near-death experience just was, made it even more intense.
Tracy, so you started, are you still skeptical when it comes to the paranormal, or has you taking these orb pictures changed that view?
Oh, it's definitely changed my view. I I'm still skeptical about certain things. I like to do research before I, you know, open my mind to it. But I'm definitely a lot more open-minded now than I was before, because I'm experiencing things that I just couldn't have even imagined.
So you just started taking pictures and noticed the orbs, or you started taking pictures because you wanted to capture orbs? How did that go?
Well, it all started when my sister invited me to a ghost conference, and it was in Seebeck, Washington, and there were a lot of mediums there and paranormal investigators there, and I was just kind of tagging along. I was a stay-at-home mom at the time, raising a couple of young boys, and
That is a full-time job. You're not kidding.
That's a full-time job. Yes. So I just wanted to tag along. I thought it sounded fun. And I happened to pull out my cell phone one night and captured these anomalies on my cell phone that were just these bright balls of light that were moving in kind of a ribbon-like pattern. And I can tell you that the feeling that I got when I took those photos was this just immense love. I mean, it's hard to describe. But when I saw those, my mind kind of blew open then. I'm like, what is that? And then the next day we went into the inn and I had my phone out and took a picture. Well, my sister intuitively said, take a picture of the stairs. You know, we're at the top of the stairs at the inn. She said, take a picture. And I took a picture and these two balls of light came moving up the stairs and we could see them in the phone display, but not with the naked eye. Moving up, and I caught a picture of these two balls of light. And I don't know if they were the same balls of light, but we both saw them and looked at each other and went, did you see that? And so that kind of opened my mind up right then. And it took me a couple years before I started doing the orb photography after that. So then I researched it first and, you know, read quite a few books and did some internet searches on it before I dove into it, because I wanted to see what I was getting into first. And then it just opened my mind after that.
Tracy, did you see these orbs in the now, or was this something only when you reviewed the picture that it dawned on you?
Well, I could see them in the phone. Now I use a camera. I don't use my phone anymore because the camera has a stronger flash. And so the orbs actually use the flash to manifest. So I can see the orbs in the camera display when I take it, you know, as I'm looking through, but I can't see them with the naked eye.
Thank you for helping us explain that. So you started taking pictures at night. Is that because these are more visible at night?
Yes, they're more visible against a dark background.
So you've captured literally thousands of these photos, correct? And I'm already getting requests. People want to know where they can see them. And I believe that's on your Facebook page, Orb Discoveries.
Actually, I have a website, orbdiscoveries.com.
There you go, orbdiscoveries.com. We'll get that out there
right,
as well.
And it's actually hundreds of thousands of photos.
Well, let's get that right first and foremost. Hundreds of thousands.
Obsessed.
Hey, do you have some favorites on there? Like ones that really stand out, or do they kind of just all look the same?
Well, my sister and I kind of laugh about that because we actually just printed up some Oracle cards. And it was really difficult because we have a lot of favorites. So, but there are certain ones that we definitely do have favorites. Wouldn't you agree with that, Sherry?
Oh, yeah. And no photo is the same. They're all completely different. And they're more than just orbs as well. If I could share a little bit, Jeremy, about.
Please do.
I've been getting orbs in my photos for about 20 years. And, you know, I never really thought that there was anything else to get but orbs. And then my sister, after she got those light anomalies in Seebeck, opened me up to other types of anomalies that are out there that, you know, if we don't know about them, we don't ask for them. They don't show up for us. So I was like, how come my sister's getting all these crazy energies? You know, she's only been doing it for a year or so, just started taking it. She was getting plasma clouds and light mists and spirit mists, I think is what we call them. And so I'm like, okay, well, I'm going to ask for this. And then one Christmas about 3 years ago, I was in Montana, and I asked for these plasma clouds, what we call plasma clouds and spirit mist. And they showed up for me. And they formed these amazing formations that where you can see, you know, beings and everything like that in them. And we see so many things in our photos that it's more than just spirit orbs, which are amazing in themselves. But there's just so much as you open up to different types of energies and open, you know, open our mind to get whatever and even ask for it. They, you know, they accommodate when we ask for things. They answer. It's a communication. So it's more than just a photo session. It's a huge communication.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Do you analyze other people's photographs?
Yes, we actually get a lot of requests when we do an event or something like that, or when I'm, when we're doing our thing. There's a lot of people that will ask us to look at their photos and see what we, you know, what we get from or what we think about it. Yeah, we get that quite a bit.
Is it easy to tell someone what it is that they're dealing with? I mean, because you've done this, you know, so long and, you know, literally hundreds of thousands of pictures, you have to have some sort of knowledge on whether or not what you're looking at is the same as another, or whether there's some way that you can explain that.
Well, after taking that many photos, you can discern whether it's something, you know, like lens flare. When you point your camera directly toward the sun, you'll get a green dot sometimes, and that's just a reflection off the lens. So you can pretty much tell when it's lens flare. Though sometimes what I've, you know, learned from taking photos is that spirit will communicate to us through lens flare too. So it doesn't always mean that it's just the mechanics of the camera. There might be more going on there. And then dust, you can usually tell the difference if it's dust or if it's an orb. Orbs tend to have a, sort of a concentric pattern inside of them, whereas dust is kind of flat, you know, and not as colorful. So I'm not saying that there aren't, you know, orbs that aren't colorful, but when you do so much of it, you can tell the difference.
Okay, so what do these orbs mean?
Wow, that's the big question. My feeling is that they are here just to communicate love to us and to help us progress on the planet.
Yeah, I agree with Tracy. And I also feel that it's, it's so multi-leveled with all, you know, when you're talking about spirit and what we call the paranormal and, you know, it's just the communications are so multi-leveled. I'll look at a photo and think, you know, and get a communication at that. And then I'll look at it later and get another communication. I believe that they're here to let us know that they're around. And, you know, they're showing in a light spectrum that we don't see with our visible eye. And the digital camera is able to pick them up. They're always here. They're just, we just don't see them with our physical eyes. Usually some people can see orbs. I see them sometimes when I'm, you know, with clients or something like that. I might see them when you're in that space and you're in that light trance or meditative space. You might be able to see it. The veil's thinning anyway. So I believe that they're here to let us know that they're around us, and it's definitely a communication. And anyone can get these, you know, we're not special. We're just obsessed. But so anyone can get these, you know, these anomalies in their photos if they just ask for it and be open to it. And, you know, and there's also a certain kind of cameras that we feel are best for this type of photography. And we've learned so much. I mean, Tracy she's a master researcher with this kind of thing. And so she knows so much about it, but yeah, I mean, it's kind of like asking, you know, I don't know why ghosts are around, you know, I mean, I think they're just here to, because they're already here.
Right. And always have been.
Yeah.
if anybody has an infrared security camera, you can see orbs on an infrared security camera. So we installed one a few months ago, and I'm seeing all kinds of paranormal stuff on it.
Okay, but who are the they? Are these departed loved ones? Are these extraterrestrials? Are these angels? Are these what?
All of the above, I think.
Yeah. What we've learned is that there's different frequencies in the anomalies that show up, and the higher the frequency, the brighter the anomaly, the brighter the orb, or the brighter the anomaly that shows up. And so there's different types of energies. We'll see orbs in different colors, and we feel that, or I do, my opinion is, with the different colors, that they're denoting kind of like an aura, like what we have here, where if they're at that, in our auras are changing too, but if they're at a state of mind or a state of communication, they might show blue or pink or green aura, or, a different color. And so the higher frequency anomalies seem to show up more with as we grow and want to communicate. As far as loved ones, I do feel that there's loved ones. I've seen faces, and we learned from a woman, Nancy Myers, who is, she's a really wonderful orb photographer and wrote a book, and after loss in her family, and we learned about that, and she's able to look at orbs and see faces and do readings that way. And we can look in orbs at orbs. Tracy calls me, and Tracy says, "Oh, you always see a face and everything," because I kind of do. But so we can look at orbs and see, see beings in there, and also in all kinds of the anomalies, we'll see human looking types of beings. And then we'll also see extraterrestrials, especially where Tracy lives in Snohomish. She's got a lot of extraterrestrial energy around there. And so she sees a lot of ETs in her photos.
Oh, you don't say, Tracy.
Oh, yes, I have. Definitely.
Lots.
I understand that these anomalies and orbs, or whatever we want to call them, these days we're getting more of them because of digital cameras. Is that correct?
Correct.
Yes. We think so.
And
yes.
Why do we know? Have any idea why that's the case?
Well, because they show up on infrared. So once the digital camera was invented, then we're able to pick them up. I've looked at old photos from 15 years ago, of my son's, and I've seen orbs in the photos, not knowing what they were then. Probably just thought it was a spot on the camera or whatever. But now I can actually discern them and see that they are orbs. A lot of the newer cameras nowadays have infrared filters, so they're a little harder to pick up orbs with those. But we buy all our cameras on eBay for like $40. So they're very inexpensive. Our favorite one is a Nikon Coolpix S100. And I think we each have three of those. So, and it's just a cheap little point and shoot camera. They tend to pick up the orbs better.
Yeah, they don't have the filters on them. And I think that orbs are actually, instead of just floating balls, I feel that they're portals. And what we're seeing is like a portal or a hole, maybe, I guess you could say, a portal to another dimension, and that's how they're showing themselves.
Mm-hmm. What do you say to those who say, well, this isn't indicative of any sort of energy, it's just dust, or it's insects, or it's something, but it's nothing?
I say, look at our photos. Because our presentation is very visual. So once you see what we've captured, your jaw will drop.
Yeah.
I mean, there's just some things that we can't explain. And there, skeptics can't explain it. So that's all I can say is just look at the photos.
Yeah, and I would say that we're not really here to convince anyone either. We're just sharing our experiences and what's true for us. And, and everyone, at their own place. And I do realize that a lot of people have to experience things on their own in order for them to be able to see things from, from someone else's perspective, if they're, you know, if they think it's just dust or a bug or something like that, you know, and there's room for that too. But we know what we experience and we're no dummies. So, you know,
and definitely having your own experience is the most important thing. So once you have that, then there's no question about what it is and what you think it may be. So,
Tracy, Sharon, right. That's all the time we have. Take a couple of seconds each to tell us about your websites and your Facebook pages and all of that good stuff.
Sure. Well, my website is SharonSananda.com. And we also have a couple of Facebook pages, the Orb Sisters on Facebook. And also Tracy's is the Orb Discoveries on Facebook as well.
And that's right. We should say that you guys are sisters.
We're sisters.
We are.
I love it. I love that very much. Best to both of you. I hope we can see you at the Oregon Ghost Conference in future years once we get through
We'll be there.
This pandemic.
Yeah, we'll be there next year.
All right. Well, stay safe. Wash your hands.
Yeah,
we'll be back. Paranormal News with Brad Bernard's coming up. It's our program, Night 2 of Ghosts of Oregon. I'm Jeremy Scott.
Into the Paranormal is streaming 24/7 on the TuneIn Radio app and at ParanormalRadio.com. Parabnormal News, I'm Brad Bernards. A rocket carrying a U.S. Space Force communication satellite lifted off from the Cape Canaveral Air Force Station on Thursday, reports the BBC.
We have ignition and liftoff of the United Launch Alliance Atlas V rocket with AEHF-6 on the first mission for the United States Space Force.
An inaccurate reading on hydraulic equipment stopped the clock for 80 minutes before the issue was resolved. President Donald Trump established the Space Force, which is focused on warfare in space, in December 2019. Lieutenant General John F. Thompson, commander of the Space and Missile Systems Center in California, explained why the launch was proceeding despite the COVID-19 pandemic. There are critical things or mission essential things that the U.S. Department of Defense does every day, even in the face of a global pandemic. We must continue to perform mission essential tasks. The payload, the $1.4 billion Advanced Extremely High Frequency Communications Satellite, will provide secure voice and data communications for the U.S. government and its international partners. Rocket debris has been discovered downrange from a recent rocket launch from Sichuan in southwest China. China successfully launched a Long March 3B rocket on March 9th, sending a navigation satellite into a geosynchronous transfer orbit around Earth. A side booster from the three-stage rocket landed downrange from the Sichuan launch site. Fortunately, the spent booster did not fall on anyone's private property. The runaway booster didn't endanger anyone's safety or life. Connect with the news at ParabnormalRadio.com. I'm Brad Bernards, Parabnormal News. Questions as we ponder what could be. You're traveling into the paranormal.
It's Night 2 of Ghosts of Oregon. I'm Jeremy Scott. Next with me is Tobe Johnson. Tobe was raised in the Pacific Northwest and learned early on that the woods surrounding his childhood home were mysterious playgrounds, not only for himself, but for what he calls the others. And over time, Tobe would go on to not only seek out locations where the others crossed through more readily, but would end up living, learning, and respecting what some would call impossible. Now with his own podcast, Strange Brow Radio, and a book on the way, the Al Moon Lab, Site 1, Toba is seeking even more evidence that certain geological sites are prone for a wide diversity of anomalous phenomena. It's good to have you here. Tobe Johnson, welcome into the paranormal.
Hey there, Jeremy. Thank you.
Tell us about what it was like to grow up around some of this mysterious phenomenon.
Well, you know, it was something that I looked for and never found until, you know, around 2007, believe it or not. I lived vicariously through pop culture like so many people. And after around 2007, at the behest of the Question of Sasquatch, it was the foundation for getting to know all the other weirdness that envelops that question.
What do you mean by the others? Can you describe what these entities are?
Well, you know, there's a lot of different names for it. I mean, the paranormal encapsulates what the others are. And so what we started to call them is the tailors. And what I mean by that is that the experiences seem to be tailor-made for individuals. And these are, imagine if you could, a tailor-made suit designed only for Jeremy, and no one else can squeeze inside of it. So these elements of synchronicity and intent with the tailor phenomena or the others or the paranormal are these individual things that happen for people that I call extended experiencers of, you know, the supernatural or extended experiences, in this case, of Sasquatch interaction. Quite literally, people that live with the phenomena of Bigfoot in their backyard or see them on multiple occasions. Now, I will tell you that over the period of 15 years, that I've come to learn that these people have the most significant encounters with the supernatural. It's not just Bigfoot encounters. They have it all. And so you will find them at a ghost convention. You will find them at MUFON conventions. You will find them at all the other, you know, including past life conventions. So these are the people that I am curious about. That's what the Al Moon's about.
Yeah, and tell us where that site is, for those who don't know, here in Oregon, little bit to the south of the Portland area, I believe down in the Cottage Grove area, is that correct?
Right. So Cottage Grove is an interesting spot for a lot of reasons. It also the place of childhood prodigy Opal Whiteley, who, if anybody knows her story, she was a child prodigy, I believe, around the age of 12 that would talk about strange fairies and beings up in the hillside near what is known as downtown Cottage Grove, and went on to be buried with Blue Bloods in England. So how did that happen? And from then on, the weirdness really, you know, starts off with gold miners up in them there hills talking about Sasquatch interaction. And those stories are so multi-layered that it really brought me, which at the time I was a Eugene, Oregon, Springfield, Oregon native, and all sorts of Bigfoot stuff started to happen around 2011, 2012, until about 2018, when I was introduced to a family, Daryl and Cindy Adams, and the Adams family, believe it or not, invited me into their crazy world. And they basically said, hey, you know, we're Bigfoot believers too. Why don't you take us out? And we did. We got to know one another. And it just so happened that they would turn into the best extended experiencers in Cottage Grove a Bigfoot guy could ever hope to be involved with.
Did you live on the site or stay there for a lengthy period of time?
Yeah. So I quickly, as soon as we found these, what turned out to be, and now that we've had them verified by, you know, a physician and a sonographer out of Harborview Medical in Seattle, we found a pair of knees, impressions of knees in the embankment above their house, brought the impressions down. As soon as we brought these impressions down, which have scaled out in volume size at over 1,000 pounds, I'm being generous. We had the hair analyzed and it came back as an unknown hair that did not, you know, fit easily into any database. And the knees are huge. I mean, they're just way too big that when an orthopedic surgeon looks at them, his mouth drops and says, there's no man that size. So as soon as we brought these down and put them inside, in this particular case, this brand new shop, metal shop that you could probably fit two small RVs in, And mind you, that Daryl was recently retired and just moved into this house with his wife. And so as soon as we put those in the shop, things just started to happen. And, you know, it was just everything, Jeremy, from, one of the first things that we noticed, this was before I lived there, is that the garage doors would open up on their own and there would be strange things placed in strange places in the garage, what I would call gifts of some kind. They were very small and maybe unnoticeable. One might think that a child had broken into the shop and left a little toy on the shelf. But I, at that time, was, you know, I had 15 or close to 15 years under my belt of interviewing extended experiencers with really weird stuff going on. And so I had my eye out, and I remember looking at Daryl and I said, listen, you know, this is probably the way this will go if we play it cool. Do you want it to happen? And being a Bigfoot guy, he goes, you know, I don't care. I mean, I think it's just a big mountain monkey, you know, probably some, you know, strange attributes, yes, but not what you're describing. And before we knew it, we started to find all sorts of signatures of the paranormal. But it was really Sasquatch latent at first, which is this gifting stuff that happens with extended experiencers. And so what do I mean? Little tiny trinkets of significance left in very unusual places for you to find them. Inside your house, for example, imagine walking into the kitchen and finding, you know, a rock the size of your fist sitting on the kitchen counter, or walking out to your car and finding a pine cone balancing without any pine trees around on your rearview mirror. Those things are hard to overlook. I understand people do, but I think when you pay attention to this, the others or the tailors start to say, oh, they want to play games. All right, you know, and then they ring the dinner bell for the rest of the paranormal to come on over. And boy, did they.
What were some of the other stories that, that people who had lived there previous to your experiences told you?
Nothing, other than the fact that we found a lot of Bigfoot activity all around their property. A lot of Sasquatch stories, including a lot of footprints that we helped cast back in 2012. So there's a lot of lore, a lot of reason to be out there. However, the neighbors, and when I say neighbors, when you live out in the woods, you know, neighbors like to have high fences for reasons. So a lot of farmers living out maybe, you know, 300 yards away, a farmer here, a farmer there. One of the farmers was a guy that we called Wormy. Wormy had a worm farm. He also logged periodically. And Wormy would tell us that he saw a blue-eyed bear come walking on two legs after him. Well, I thought that was pretty interesting. It turns out that a couple people saw blue-eyed beings walking towards them at night in that area. Another gal said that her father's cat went missing. 2 weeks later, the cat showed up on the back patio with a smushed head. The skull had been completely smashed, and it was just laid right there in the back of his patio by the window. Now, I don't think that that cat got his head smashed on its own and just laid there. I think it was a delivered, you know, kill. Now, there's a logging road near there, and a lot of the Sasquatch, you know, extended experience will tell you that these beings will deliver things, especially things that you're missing. And I think quite possibly that cat was killed on that logging road after a period of time, or maybe even farther away, and brought back to this poor old guy. So they had some stories.
Fascinating stories for sure, Tobe. So you believe that there is some sort of a connection between what is going on there at the Al Moon Lab site and the paranormal world as a whole, say maybe a connection that would explain ghosts and UFOs and portals and all of that.
Look into the, you know, the evidence that George Knapp and, you know, Colonel John B. Alexander unearthed in Utah at the Skinwalker Ranch, and you'll learn very quickly that these places exist all over the globe. Where and why they exist and how, I don't really know. Nobody does. That's the fun of looking. This was one of those places. So we called it a skin twin, right? It's a twin to a skinwalker. So it's a skin twin. And these skin twins erupt at different times. It's almost like an electrical charge starts to bloom, or some kind of weather cycle or earth anomaly, or maybe you have some new people over at a skin twin and they kind of want to check you out. A lot of gamesmanship. That's where this whole trickster thing comes in, attaching itself to things like this. So the trickster, the others, the tailors, the paranormal, there is no way to study it. All you can do is hope to have a two-way conversation with something that generally likes to have a monologue instead of a dialogue. But it totally moved me away from the flesh and blood phenomena. I mean, I was pretty much already there, but after 2017 and 2018 in particular, there was no place, for me to go other than a rabbit hole with this.
Did you have the knee prints analyzed? I know I talked to you a couple years ago in McMinnville at the UFO Fest, and you were showing me some of the evidence at that point. I know you were planning on getting them analyzed. Has that been done, or what's the plan with that?
Yeah. So we had a sonographer, a guy by the name of Dragoo, and he wrote a 2.5 page scientific paper that has not been peer reviewed. And then we had a Boeing engineer do volume metrics on how much weight it would take to displace the kind of substrate where we found these. The hair was looked at. So we have, a paper trail from those three sources that say, yes, these are knees. We can see the anatomy that makes these knees. These are way too large to be a human, and they're way too out of proportion to be an animal. So therefore, they are an unknown. That I will say. But they do match other attributes of things that people have found, including the Skookum cast, right, which is another Bigfoot anomaly. And there's some other casts out there as well. But in my opinion, because the supernatural is so attached to this story, and yes, it's a separate issue, but I believe strongly that synchronicity is at play here, and that by us bringing those knees down, we invited this activity. At least it really seemed to be interested in where we put those knees, because most of the activity seemed to happen where we housed them, which was this metal shop. Now, there was ghost stuff going on, bonkers ghost stuff. Aside from having a full body apparition, which I did see something on one occasion, and so did Daryl on a different occasion, including something that had the traditional predator pixelation look in broad daylight. There was EVPs almost every day in and around the property, footsteps, weather anomalies. In the midsummer, it rained, a light mist. As we stood there in the gravel driveway, there was property damage. Imagine grain gutters squeezed about 11 feet up, and then you could see the muddy hair impressions of an arm reaching up and squeezing these brand new rain gutters. Giant handprints that we were able to successfully dust print and take and salvage as evidence. Daryl Sims, the alien hunter, right? He looked at some of these prints that we got of what looked like little tiny gray's handprints, according to Daryl, that were infused as a chalky white little four-fingered handprint in one of the guest bedroom doors. The story is just so incredible. There's 1,200 hours. Imagine that. 1,200 hours worth of audio over a period of 4 months from three or two different audio sources, including parabolic recordings. Some of the recordings, specifically of the Bigfoot stuff, were sold to the latest Travel Channel's Bigfoot show that aired. And one of the doctors, I forget the gal's name, actually got a response with some of the sounds from the Al Moon Lab. It was actually some of the best evidence that they got right off the bat was by utilizing what is a traditional Bigfoot roar out in Sisters, Oregon. So it's an amazing spot. And unfortunately, the homeowner sold it. Interesting enough, this couple came in and paid cash and bought it from him. And they are science fiction fans, according to what I've last heard. I haven't spoken to them directly, but it's still an area that we work periodically. The area above it still is accessible. And so for Daryl's credit, he's got a lot more evidence since leaving the property believe it or not. And a lot of that is in track waveform. So now for the first time, we are bringing back a size 14 and a half, size 15, very deep Sasquatch impressions.
And I understand that there was some hair involved as well that mm-hmm. you guys discovered.
Well, Sarah Lemos, psychic Sarah Lemos, I don't know if she's been interviewed yet by you, but she was at the McMinnville UFO Festival, and I'd never met her. In fact, it was just kind of a weird meeting, and before I knew it, I was having a conversation with
actually,
a gal.
I don't mean to interrupt, but she actually told this story on my show back in August at the Oregon Bigfoot Festival, and okay. So my audience is familiar with it, but we'd love to get your perspective of this story.
Yeah, so if anybody goes to Strange Brow Radio on YouTube, BRAU, it's a German reiteration for Brewhouse, Strange Brow Radio, you will see a very shaved head version of Sarah Lemos talking about her psychometry reading of holding the hair. And to that point, as far as I recall, she was a skeptic. And it was a touching that hair that she had her mind blown. And we knew nothing about that hair other than the fact that report came back from Cindy Dosa. Now, I gave a hair to George Knapp that was embedded in plaster, handed it right to the guy. Never heard back from George Knapp about that. So, George, if you're listening, it's time to talk. I know a skin twin, and if you have some investors, let me know. Maybe we can talk these folks from Beverly Hills out of their place.
Yeah, it was absolutely fascinating because you're right. She told me that was the moment when she believed in Bigfoot.
Yeah, I'd love to touch bases with her. I've tried a couple different times, and I know she's super busy with everything. We're all super busy, but now we've got nothing but time. So, Sarah, if you're listening, please reach out. We need to talk about that hair.
Yes, exactly. And I understand that back to the prints, I guess the analysis found that it could not be a bear, could not be an elk, could not be a cougar, and could not be a human, that it had to be some sort of larger-than-human-like subject.
Well, a human-like subject that leapt knees first into the mud off an old skid road, which would be a very weird thing for somebody to do, and bare legs, especially going down as deep as they did. We found hair about 12 feet above it on the ridge in a dug fir tree about 5 feet up. There was mud and hair on the dug fir bark. I think that the thing was leaping for some reason. I think these were incredibly fresh tracks when we found them, and it was spring loading itself up to a hill. I was basically asked to go look for a tree near this point. So there's a lot of interesting stuff about the knees, but Jeremy, the most interesting stuff is the idea that there's portals, that there's very complex language that I don't believe is Sasquatch that communicated with us, including these mystery women. There was apportations that happened. We were able to record apportations as they happened. I don't know anybody. Well, I've seen a couple cases, of course, of people that are super diligent about apportations actually occurring.
Now, explain that for some who don't know what that is.
Sure. So an apportation or a deportation is something that you hear pop into existence. So a lot of these snaps, pops, hits, cracks, even wood knocks, I believe, are energy passing through matter. So if you hear wood knock, you hear cement knock or slap. Oftentimes, I think that's some kind of entity or spirit form or energy passing through. Now, objects pass through as well, and that's what an apportation is, out of thin air. And so we documented on two occasions objects transferring from Port Orchard, Washington, down to Cottage Grove, Oregon. We were able to document it based upon size, scale, and real specific information about these objects. Another time, an object left from Cottage Grove, Oregon, to Eugene, Oregon, and landed on the threshold of a bathroom. We were able to document both of those things. And so this is what people are talking about. This is why science fiction exists, is because they didn't make up this stuff and have an acid trip. These stories have been around for eons, and nobody believes them. And so, therefore, now they are science fiction. They are fantasy. They are ghost stories. They are, you know, no, they're real. And it's time people get over it. We're at the edge of disclosure. I think we're in a liminal state. I know we're in a liminal state right now as a populace, and stuff's about to go down.
Well said, Tope. So tell us about everything you got coming up. I know you have a book in the works and lots of evidence on your Facebook page and again, the radio show as well.
Yeah, well, people are at home. Everyone's downloading, listening. It's hard to get stuff out via mail, snail mail, Amazon. So we're doing an audiobook. But this isn't just any audiobook. I'm doing a fully immersive audiobook complete with all the audio, 1,200 hours. So we're talking about the story from 2007 to where we are now at what I call the El Moon Altar, which is an active spot up here in the Olympic Peninsula. So it's coming out. Probably take me a couple of weeks to do it. And then if you go to patreon.com/strangebrowradio, you get the download.
All right, that's Tope Johnson. And again, we have all of the links to all of the guests tonight up at my website, paranormalradio.com. So I know we're going to go fast and furiously through the guests tonight. And I want Tope to hang around because a friend of his is going to be joining us here after the top of the hour, who actually visited the Al Moon Lab site as well and can add some additional perspective. But for those who are wanting the links to all of the guests tonight, we do have those up and posted at paranormalradio.com. So you can click and see all of the evidence for yourself. Highly, highly recommended. We'll continue. Tope Johnson will stick with us. William Becker is coming up next. And Jeff Davis in the final half hour. It's Ghosts of Oregon tonight, our virtual broadcast of the Oregon Ghost Conference. I'm Jeremy Scott, and we'll be back.
Save your data and listen for free by calling 701-719-9703, courtesy of TalkStream Live.
Crossover here. Tope Johnson sticking around with us from the Al Moon Lab, and joining us is William Becker. A little bit about William. He was on the show last year from the Oregon Ghost Conference. He's a psychic and medium who works with others to integrate their own specific spirituality into their everyday lives through psychic development classes and events, speaking engagements, and several types of readings, mentoring, and psychic life coaching. He's a paranormal enthusiast and an experienced paranormal investigator. William combines his love of history and psychic abilities to allow people inside the world of ghosts, hauntings, and other paranormal realms. His philosophy is that the more we know of our past lives, as well as the beings and worlds around us, the better we know how to more fully experience and live this life. William is author of Paranormal Insights, a visual parahistory of Oregon and Washington, which I do highly recommend. Welcome to the program, William Becker.
Thank you so much, Jeremy. It's a pleasure to be here.
I understand you went down to the property down there in Cottage Grove yourself?
Yes, I did. It was last year, and we were there during the middle of the day. It's fascinating.
What happened while you were there?
Well, he showed me, We talked to the owner as well briefly, but mostly it was just he and I. And he showed me where a lot of the different things had happened and some of the gifts and the casts and such. I picked up, oh, geez. And Tobe, you may have to help me here because I read so many entities in so many places. They come, you know, once I'm done a year later, I don't remember who said what unless I check notes. But we definitely picked up quite a few different people, including somebody, a man, I think it was in the shop area in the corner, and quite a few areas like that. And then he also put together, we chose some things and put together a bit of an experiment. And what was it, the next day you went out or the day after and things had definitely been tampered with. They'd been moved, and something had been replaced, if I remember right.
Right. Sometimes when you had visitors, especially someone as gifted as, you know, a psychic out there, they really latch on to that. And William was that latching on. And they would let us know, usually through a recording, what they thought of that person. Or they would, and what I mean by that is that it would kind of pay homage to something that we spoke about. It was a lot like having a genie in a bottle. And so the specifics behind what they did with William is that they would, we were unearthing a little silly putty egg, I believe, when William was up there to see if there was a gift inside the silly putty itself, because previous to that, they had unearthed it and stuck a little tiny glass bead or plastic bead in the silly putty and then buried it again. And they did something similar to that effect after William left, which I thought was a good sign. But I remember, William, you saying that, you know, there was a man energy in particular over in a corner of the shop that I explained earlier, and that was one of the most active areas that he was pointing out. So that was encouraging.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think I'm getting a picture back again of what the man was, or was looking like to me. Kind of a thin man, overalls. I can't remember exactly, but that's what's coming through now. A strange shape of a hat. And right. I don't remember if that's what I saw then, but that's...
Tobe, do we know who that could have been?
Well, there is a sect, a religious sect that developed in the 1800s. Before Cottage Grove was a town, there was a religious sect called the Hebrons. And that is kind of the end of the book here, what the Hebrons might have been and who they were. Now, we had always felt, you know, since the Hebrons were basically in Cottage Grove Lake, before it was a lake, they had a church down there, that they had pushed themselves into the hillsides near where this property was. And some of the EVPs we got sounded like old Baptist sermons happening, you know, fire and brimstone kind of stuff. So did William pick up on a parishioner or a pastor or, you know, a healer? I don't know, but I wish we would have had more time with people like William out in that spot.
It was fascinating. I would like to have gone out back again. And if I remember right, too, it was easy to tell. I mean, we could pick up a lot of things from the woods, even though they were a little ways away. But partly with Bigfoot, but was partly with other beings, some of them miners, some of them traders, a variety of things coming through there. And Cottage Grove itself, too. I think it's a little different there, but it's similar. I think that's that whole area, I think, is very active with a variety of types of entities.
Yeah, very unusual town. And William was picking up on that.
Yeah, it's a great place. I like the people I talk to and all the rest of it. The experiments Tobe was doing, though, really fascinating to me. And a lot of what you were talking about had happened, and the confirmation science. And
right. I mean, the name Lab, of course, Al Moon Lab, the lab portion was that we were being studied. We weren't studying anything. We were, you know, basically videotaping and recording us being studied by them. So that was the humorous part, to utilize that name. And so the experiments we would set up would garner evidence of some kind, but it was never repeatable. They were the only ones that knew about space and time and a whole different realm.
Exactly. And you could feel them. They were close by. They were up in the woods. They were watching.
Wow. Well, I wanted to bring you on, William, and to add to the experience of what just sounds like literally an out-of-this-world location down in Cottage Grove. Again, you can follow that on Tobe's Facebook page. Is that the best place for folks to look for evidence? I think you have a YouTube channel as well.
Yeah, just go to strangebrowradio.com and listen to a podcast. I talk all about it all the time.
Fantastic. Tobe, thanks, and best to you.
All right. Bye, William. Bye, Jeremy.
Bye, Joe.
You wrote a book about the history, the para-history, as you call it, of Washington and Oregon. So I'd be interested in diving into that. some here, and you also bring your psychic abilities along with you, which is fascinating because you're not just a documentarian of the paranormal, but you're able to add that psychic insight as well when you're at these locations. Do you mind telling us about a few of these?
No, not at all. And actually, I've got a second book out too, Footsteps of My Forebears, which takes a tour to the Volga German area in Russia and my ancestors' village and my readings and such of that. They're both on my website. And the first book, the one that you've mentioned, a good friend of mine, Devin Conroy Groves, is a professional photographer. And so he did the photos on that book. And we traveled to a lot of different locations around Oregon and Washington. We were in Chanico, of course, Astoria, Battery Russell, with Peter Ardale, quite a bit in Oregon City, and several places in Washington. And what I would do is I'd read what was coming to me as a psychic and a medium, and then also put in the history of the location, the legends, anything that kind of interacted and interconnected, and then along with his photography. And I think it's a beautiful book. The work he does is outstanding. But let's see, one of the places that we went to a cemetery at night, and I won't give out the name simply because of vandalism. It's tucked out in the way, or out of the way, and kind of in the middle of nowhere. I had permission to do what we were doing. I was given the key and the blessings of the cemetery people. And we went out there to explore a bit and take pictures. His camera, his professional camera, would only take one picture, only one work the entire time we were in the cemetery. And that's the one we put in the book. And we saw the usual shadowy figures moving around and all that. It's really, it's a beautiful place and very historic. And it's just a shame people come in and vandalize the place and do rituals that are inappropriate. So we had the picture, and I went back on my own then a bit after that at night by myself. And I'm one of these people that, ghosts don't scare me. People scare me. And so I'm always a little nervous walking a half mile into the woods when I can't see lights or hear other people. And coming back on the trail, which is actually part of the old Oregon Trail, something pulled my pants leg and I stopped and looked. There was nothing around. And I had a very strange sense, one that was starting to become a little frightening to me, which is strange. So I stopped and I looked, and there were thousands of Native Americans on the east side of this trail, not on the west side. And they had a story to tell that they wanted me to tell. And so I put that into the book as well. And they talked about how disease had come west before the settlers did. The diseases had weakened the tribes. Intertribal warfare had gotten worse, and tribes were decimating each other. And then the settlers came and made it even worse. And they were talking, it's long story short, basically. What happens when a group of people is degraded and dehumanized and going from being proud and honorable in their practices within their hierarchy and their social value set to even murder and theft inside their own villages, inside their own communities. And just because people were so desperate. And it was a very powerful time. They didn't want me to stand there. They wanted me to keep walking, as they told me. So I did. And it was, about the shortcomings of them and their society, as well as the harm the European-based people had done. And to add a little bit more to this, this is only a mile and a half away from where the five Cayuse were tried and hung for the Whitman Massacre in 1847. 1851, I think, is when they were tried and hung. So there's a lot of power in that area. That's probably the strongest piece from that book.
Now, you also believe that our past lives are really important in the overall scheme of things.
I do, yes. Our past lives can shape part of what we're interested in and what we do now. It's not so much a karma thing where, oh, we were bad in the past life, so we're going to have good things this life, or any of that. But a lot of times I work with somebody, and for example, yes, you were doing a lot of work with herbs here. You were accused of witchcraft here, but you were helping people, healing basically. There's this, and then find out that they really enjoy helping people heal. They want to be a midwife or a nurse or a doctor. Or I'll read somebody that had several deaths of drowning, and it's, hey, no wonder you're afraid of the water. And once we find out what's behind these things, like the fear factor piece, we can work beyond it. We can take the fear out of it because it's no longer an unknown. Or when we find you did his illustrations here, you were a writer here, you were a writer here, no wonder you're frustrated with what you're doing here. Explore that writing side of you. Explore the creative side of you that's wanting to come out. And even if it's not professional, it can make a difference. Or people's attraction to places. A lot of the places I've traveled to, or the countries anyway, I've stumbled into past lives of mine just because I recognize it. And so when somebody's particularly drawn to an area, it could be from a past life that it's a good place for them to be. If they're particularly repulsed, it could be a past life that was a bad place to be. So we can put all the pieces together and help form a more complete picture.
Yeah. Do you think that all of us have experienced a past life, that we're all just reincarnations of something that we were previously?
I think so, for the most part. I'm not going to say there aren't new souls coming out periodically. I've met some people that have had very few past experiences that I could read anyway. I mean, I read what's significant at the time is usually what's shown to me. But I think most of us have, and if we haven't, we will. And not everybody's the same on how many they've had or how far back they go. And it's not a race or a contest. It doesn't really matter. It's part of our learning. It's part of our soul learning for making our own soul more complete, even though when we're on earth living, we don't always remember so much of the past. I don't know if that makes sense.
No, it does. It does.
Okay.
William, do you find that you get strong urges or sensations when you walk into certain places? So I guess it would be randomly. Do those things happen to you?
They do. I have to tune into it. I'm easily distracted. And so if I'm in the middle of a conversation about something totally different, the location's going to have really strong energy to make me aware of it. But if I go in, or once I turn on to pay attention to it, very much so. And some places, the awe of the place, I mean, the first time I walked into Hagia Sophia, it's a place I wanted to go since I could hold up a National Geographic on my own. And the awe and wonder of this building and this history and the spirituality that was there for actually thousands of years. That was so overpowering. It took me a bit to tune into the more metaphysical part of it, the esoteric, paranormal, whatever the word you want to use. And it was, places like that are just amazing to me.
I'd be interested in maybe what you're feeling now with this day and age, because there's a lot of energy going around right now, William.
There is, and there's a lot of fear, and some of that fear has been provoked deliberately to create chaos. I don't read the future. The future can change, and it's too big of a responsibility. I don't want somebody to change their jobs or marry somebody because I said so and turn out I'm wrong. But like I said, the future changes anyway. I'm not going to say what's going to happen because I'm not sure, but I keep in mind that all species end at some point and all societies crumble. I don't think we're there yet, but it feels like this could be the beginning of something like that. I think we'll get, you know, hopefully we'll get through this and everything will be fine. That's just me as a person, not a psychic or a medium. I think whatever happens in the long run, it will be okay. I don't think this is created by any evil presence. It's just one of those things that happens in nature.
Wow.
And how it's handled is a different story. That's human.
Yeah. Well, as dire as it is, that is a little bit somewhat comforting, William.
Yeah, good. And I don't know. It's so difficult to sit here in my living room, and I don't have the virus. I don't know anybody that does. And you hear about what's going on in so many countries, but here where I live, it's not business as usual. Well, everything's shut down, but the hospitals aren't overflowing and none of that. Hopefully they won't get that way. Hopefully we'll.
We're very lucky because just a little bit to the north of us, Washington is up there with New York, you know, the hardest hit here in the U.S. So we want to wish everybody safety and good health going forward. Same to you, William. I'm honored to have you on the program.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
So paranormalinsights.net, that's where folks should go?
Yes. Uh-huh. And you can link up to my social media through there as well.
Fantastic. And we do have that linked up at paranormalradio.com. Best to you, William.
Thank you so much, Jeremy. Take care.
Absolutely. Our program will continue. Ghosts of Oregon. You want to talk ghosts? The man is Jeff Davis, and he's coming up right after this.
Make sure to subscribe to Into the Paranormal's free YouTube channel for shows, news, and exclusive reports. Abnormal News. I'm Brad Bernards. Most Bigfoot sightings these days are written accounts by someone who was intentionally looking for the creature. It's rare to see and hear an unintentional eyewitness describe their confrontation, especially mere minutes after the sighting, and see their expressions of sheer terror and confusion.
Well, he was black. He was all bent over. He had big. His feet was real big.
It scare you?
Yeah.
How tall would you say he was?
He was real tall. He had big hands.
Jesse Walker says he was taking out the trash on March 20th when he saw Bigfoot. He told the story to Stephen Barcello, founder and owner of Cryptozoology and Paranormal Museum.
I believe what people told me, but it's real now. I know I saw Bigfoot.
Walker is extremely unsettled, or a very good actor. It doesn't appear anyone else in the area saw the Bigfoot, and the local media coverage is sparse. Poor old Uranus just can't seem to catch a break. Something already tipped the planet on its side, so its orbit is perpendicular to those of the other solar system planets. It probably smells terrible, and now scientists have discovered that the atmosphere of Uranus is leaking out into space. Hidden in the data from Voyager 2's historic 1986 encounter with the icy planet was the presence of a plasmoid, a pocket of atmospheric material being funneled away from Uranus by the planet's magnetic field. Connect with the news at parabnormalradio.com. I'm Brad Bernards, Parabnormal News.
Step. Hide under your blankets. Whatever you do, prepare yourself for what's coming through your speakers into the Parabnormal.
Our program tonight, Ghosts of Oregon, continues. I'm Jeremy Scott, 855-790-8255. Toll free in North America, get 855-790-8255. Or outside North America, it's 503-506-0396. International and Skype callers can get through at ITP51. My next guest is Jeff Davis, who has lived in the peculiar world, as he calls it, for most of his life. As a boy, he decided to become an archaeologist and investigate the odd and unusual after watching the original Mummy movie with Boris Karloff. For many years, Jeff worked in the woods of the Pacific Northwest Cascade Mountains, and he's encountered many peculiar things while traveling around the world as well. Jeff has written, edited, or contributed over a dozen books, including on topics of military history and the paranormal. Some of those include Weird Washington and Weird Oregon. He's also been a guest on Haunted History, Ghost Adventures, and even The Dead Files. Jeff Davis, welcome into the Parabnormal.
Welcome. Well, thank you very much. And I was going to say welcome to you, too, but this is your show.
You can welcome me to my own show. I'd be honored.
Thank you.
Well, you know, I'm honored to have you here. I've got a copy of Portland's Rose City Ghosts number one in my hands right here.
Uh-huh.
And I loved it. We're talking about locations right here in my backyard, place that I grew up here in Portland, and lots of places that I didn't even know had some of this history. So I love this book.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. One of the things I try and do, because I have such a mixed background, as you read my bio, to people who do history, I'm the ghost guy who talks a little bit of history. To people in the paranormal, I'm the historian who sort of does ghosts. I try and blend the two.
There is a lot of ghosts in history and vice versa. You would agree, not only here in the Pacific Northwest, but all around the world.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is the thing, in people who are listening to this program and people who buy books and visit websites on this, is I think that these people really love history. What makes a ghost story interesting is not the phenomena itself. It's not that at 2 o'clock in the morning the doorbell rings and there's nobody there. It's who 100 years ago or 30 years ago used to get up and ring the doorbell, or what incident happened. They want to know the story behind the phenomena, and that's history.
Yeah, exactly. You see an apparition, or you smell something or you pick up on some sort of characteristic, you want to know, like, was there somebody back in the day who you could tie this to? And a lot of times it's family members, depending on what kind of sites we're talking about. It could be, you know, somebody that's not even related to you. But history, yeah, we're all kind of interested in that as well. It's not just that somebody was scared by a ghost or that they, you know, what they saw, but we want to know exactly what's behind it. You're exactly right about that. It's very important.
Yeah, I think so, too. And it ties us to the past. Especially as you pointed out, if it's a family member, if it's at a family house, more real, I think, to a lot of people. The paranormal becomes more real than if it's on paper. You experience it yourself, and so there's you walking back and forth in history. One of the theories is that time is not linear in a straight line. Time is like a river, and it eddies, and the current goes left and then curves and comes right. And some people believe that if you're in one location, the location is set, but the time changes, and sometimes something happens, the energy is right, and you can sort of look back and forth through time. And so we may be somebody else's ghost because they see us in the past or the present.
That's very true, because we don't necessarily understand how this all works, how, you know, we interact with them and they interact with us.
Yeah, I think so, too. And unfortunately, we won't know until we pass on, and then getting word back to our friends and relatives is a little more difficult.
Now, I know you've written a little bit about military history. So have you talked about, you know, battlefields and the like?
Yeah. And because we were kind of talking about Oregon and Washington ghosts, there actually are a couple of, well, several battlefields in and around our area, the Portland-Vancouver area, over by the Bonneville Dam, more on the Washington side. In 1856, there were a series of battles fought between the Yakima Indian tribe and their allies and the U.S. Army. And one of these spots actually has a historic marker on it. It was the middle Cascades, and there was a blockhouse, and there were 8 soldiers in the blockhouse, and then the natives attacked, and everybody, local townspeople, kind of piled in with them, and they held off an attack for about 3 days. And some people believe they hear echoes of that battlefield there on that kind of high point with this interpretive marker. And a lot of people have had some kind of an emotional response there.
Yeah, I can imagine that they would. So what other sites have you investigated or researched about here in the Pacific Northwest? I know hotels and cemeteries are among them. Give folks an overview of some of the places you write about.
Yeah, there are so many. And I think kudos and credit to how open-minded people in the Pacific Northwest are to talking about this phenomenon. Many of the McMenamins properties, they specifically buy old properties and rehab them. So a lot of those properties, in particular, they now own the White Eagle Saloon off of North Russell Street in Portland, and that is extremely haunted. I've spent several nights there investigating just with gizmos, instruments, and separately with clairvoyance. And what's fun and fascinating for me is visiting a location like the White Eagle, and there are still people who have not heard of it. And so bringing them in and then asking them to participate in investigation, and sometimes phenomena does happen. For instance, the women's restroom on the ground floor, stories collected even before I was researching talk about how the women's restroom is haunted, and that women will be sitting in one of the stalls, and there will be like a toilet paper fight with somebody who's in the stall next to them, And when the person kind of gets up and washes their hands, getting ready to leave, they find that all of the stalls are empty, that they were alone in that bathroom when this toilet paper fight happened. And I brought somebody in with me, did not tell her anything about the ghost, and she had some weird things happen in that bathroom, in that her stall door unlocked itself while she was in there. And she heard the snick, like a metallic snick, and she didn't know what it was until she got up and found out that it was her door was now unlocked.
Yeah, there's something to these stories when you hear them, Jeff, that just kind of really fascinate. I mean, they fascinate me. They have to fascinate you as well. Did it start at a particular point in life for you? I know as a child you were really interested in archaeology. When did the whole ghosts and critters come into to play for you?
It was kind of a gradual thing. I had always been interested in ghosts, and the original Mummy movie, I would encourage anybody who's curious about filmmaking or the paranormal, the Boris Karloff is only in his mummy makeup for about 2 minutes. He's only wearing the bandages. By and large, the rest of the movie has to do with magic and reincarnation and ghosts and spirits and channeling and things like that. And so that got me started. What ended up happening, like anybody else's life, you get interested in something, and then life pulls you a different direction, and then a couple years later, you kind of get pulled back. I would say that I'd always been interested in the paranormal, but I had a girlfriend who actually said, "Oh, why don't we go to all these haunted places that you keep on telling me about?" And that really started it. And this was, I was in my early 30s at the time, and I was in the Army Reserves, and I was deployed to Bosnia in 1997. And then I came back, and I found myself as an archaeologist, unemployed, kind of in between jobs. And so I said, well, why don't I start writing books on the subject? I got a little money saved up. And that really was what launched it, was kind of this period of unemployment.
Yeah, it's a, well, and a lot of that's going on right now. A lot of folks are out of jobs, and their creative juices are flowing now. That's where we are, sad to say. What would be some of the top sites you would recommend to those here who want to come to the Pacific Northwest for a little bit of a paranormal tour? Where are some of the sites you would steer them to? Maybe a few in Washington and Oregon.
Sure. Are you interested in kind of self-guiding or guided tours themselves?
Particularly ones that folks could probably do themselves, or, you know, with a little bit of guidance on site. Maybe not ones off the beaten path, you know, where they have to get permission to enter, that kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you for mentioning getting permission to enter. Sometimes I just try and work this in. I myself don't advocate going anywhere where there are no trespassing signs, or even if it's a little iffy. Every place in the United States is owned by somebody. And so make sure you have permission to be in a location before you go in. And for goodness sakes, don't go into cemeteries at 2 o'clock in the morning. I'm not afraid of ghosts. I'm afraid of other strange people who tend to hang out in cemeteries. But, recommendation wise, actually go online. Visit my website, ghostsandcritters.com. Visit other people's websites. Do a Google search. If you want to go to Seattle, Google Haunted Seattle. And you can very quickly these days find listings of places, haunted hotels, haunted restaurants. And that's what I call recreational ghost hunting, where you plan a vacation or an outing in haunted locations in the hope that something will happen, that you will be kind of observant and paying attention, and then you may well pick up on the phenomena. In the Seattle area, of course, there are the tours, the Ross Allison's tour of kind of the old town Seattle. There's the underground tours, and kind of with that in mind, again, Kell's Irish Pub used to be a mortuary, it was the basement spaces of the mortuary, and some people believe that the crematorium for the Butterfield was located there, and they still report phenomena. In the Seattle Underground, the Scandinavian American Bank, people have seen bank guards, the ghostly bank guard, as well as what look like ghostly prospectors hanging out in the underground. In Portland, Old Town Pizza, which is the start of a starting location of two different ghost walks in that block, but people believe that a former madam haunts part of Old Town Pizza, and so she's kind of in the public spaces. That's, I guess, one of the tricks is do your homework, find some locations, and make sure the places that people say are haunted are these public locations. There are many, many of them. Some people believe even the governor's mansion in Olympia is haunted, too, by a little boy.
And again, folks can go to your website and check out some of your books. And really, if they want a road trip and go on some haunted locations, you know, he mentioned the McMinniman's properties as well. I've been out there to the Grand Lodge, so I know that there's some weird stuff that goes on out there. And then Hotel Oregon, where the McMinniman's UFO Fest is housed. People have been known to see things out there. And then, of course, Edgefield, which is out in Troutdale. I've been there. And also the Kennedy School, where the Paranormal Pub is at. So there is some history here in the Northwest, and if folks are interested, you know, once we get out of this quarantine or out of this lockdown and the pandemic seems to be clearing up, you know, I know that a lot of the businesses, particularly on the Oregon coast and in some of these small rural towns, are really going to need our business to survive. Do you plan on writing any new books coming up? I mean, you have quite many of them now, but anything inspiring you to write something new, Jeff?
Yes. One of the books that I wrote some years ago was A Haunted Tour Guide to the Pacific Northwest, which really is kind of a reference that would work well for a lot of your audience. It's a couple years old, and the average lifespan of any tour guide is not all that long. So I was in the process of revising it. There are 197 places in the present guide. It's a paper book, and I was going to put it out in spring as an ebook, Nook, Kindle, and so on. Unfortunately, my father is not well, and so I'm his primary care person. So I have to kind of set aside the publishing for a while. I'm in the midst also of putting out Vancouver, USA Ghosts Volume 2. I was born in Vancouver, Washington, lived there my entire life. I was in the Army and Army Reserves, and I actually was in effect, the Army historian for the Vancouver Barracks, which existed since 1849. So I'm in the midst of revising that, the second volume of that, too.
What are some of the stories from the barracks there?
Well, public places in particular, getting back to what can your audience folk do kind of on their own. This is the nice thing. The original parade ground still exists from 1849 to now, and people believe that they have seen a ghostly sentry on that parade ground. And that part of the ground is owned by the National Park Service. It's open to the public. The ghost usually is seen at night, although some people believe that in one particular case, this woman was driving down the road that kind of outlines the parade ground, and her young son said, "I see a man in a strange uniform, strange clothing," and so he has been seen by multiple people. When this sequestration, whatever they want to call it, ends, there is the original headquarters building still exists, dates to 1849, and it's called the Grant House. It's a restaurant. People believe there are five or six ghosts that haunt there, and people believe that the Blue Lady was seen as recently as 2019, so it's still an active haunt.
Well, Jeff, I'm always interested by your work. I'm sorry that we couldn't see you at the Ghost Conference this year, and I know you were also planning on coming, I think, to the Oregon Bigfoot Festival as well, and so all of that is now just kind of on hold, but as soon as we get through this, it'll be nice to talk with you once again.
Yes, absolutely. This is the bad thing about let's face it, living in a real world where we do have crises at times, and I miss going out, meeting people live once a month on a, like one Sunday a month, I host in what I call the informal paranormal pub in Vancouver. There's a haunted place, a haunted bar called the Ender Bar. And we just get together and hang out and talk ghosts. That's kind of our primary thing, is you have to want to talk about the paranormal to go there. And I'm looking forward to seeing more people then, and meeting up and attending some of these conferences. I'm missing the Bigfoot Festival.
Yes. Well, ghostsandcritters.com, there's lots of reading material that folks can find there, and links to your books as well. So I highly recommend that they do that. Jeff, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me. And yes, hopefully we can do more things in the future.
Absolutely. That's Jeff Davis. He's the Ghosts and Critters guy. His website is ghostsandcritters.com. I want to thank everybody for tuning in this weekend. It's been a privilege to do this show virtually for you. I certainly would have much rather we have done it all three nights down in Seaside at the Oregon Ghost Conference, but I have all the faith in the world that next year we're going to be back to normal. Things are going to be a lot less rocky, and people are going to be healthier, and it's going to be a better time for us to gather together to entertain those subjects somewhere between abnormal and paranormal. From the cold, dark depths of a secret dungeon somewhere deep in the remote Pacific Northwest, I'm Jeremy Scott. Night-night, friends. Stay safe.